Hello and welcome to Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record permanently archived at vnnforum.com. Today is the penultimate recording of George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power. We're going to do chapter 14, which is not very long. And then the last session we'll do 15 and 16 to end his last book before he was assassinated, White Power. So picking it up, chapter 14 is titled White Revolution. Page 246 of 272 in the PDF, which you can find online, I believe. George Lincoln Rockwell, White Power, Chapter 14, White Revolution. Before going further, says Rockwell, let's briefly review what we've already covered in the first 12 chapters of White Power. I presented the thesis that Western society is sick, rotten, and dying, but most of its citizens don't seem to care. Chapter 1, Death Rattle. Our people, especially our youth, are spiritually lost, empty. Chapter 2, Spiritual Syphilis. These are parenthetical after his explanation of what he's covered so far. This sick, rotten, spiritually empty state of our people is not natural degeneration, natural, it's unnatural, but the result of the efforts of a gang of, quote, liberal, unquote, liars, the chart forgers. The purpose of these lying chart forgers is to pile up Western civilization on the rocks so that, like the old-time shipwreckers, they can loot and enslave our people. Chapter 3, Chart Forgers. To hurry our ship of state onto the rocks, the shipwreckers have installed as our captains in quotes, nothing but crooks and traitors, Joe Biden, for example, working with the shipwreckers. Chapter 4, Crooked Captains. The chart forgers and shipwreckers are led by a breed of people called Jews. Chapter 5, The Shipwreckers. The Jewish breed is leading the shipwreckers, crooked captains, and chart forgers in a conspiracy to smash Western civilization and the white race because they are mentally ill. They suffer from mass paranoia, his diagnosis of Jews. They're mentally ill. They suffer from mass paranoia, these Jews. They believe they are God's chosen people and always innocent scapegoats, the classic symptoms of paranoia. They have developed these crazy ideas into a religion because they are basically parasites that will not work and must get a living off other people, like tapeworms. Healthy societies always purge these human tapeworms out. Jews can live only in an unhealthy society, just as tapeworms can live only in an unhealthy and unclean body. Jews, therefore, foster every kind of degeneracy and chaos so that they can suck the blood of an unhealthy people. Chapter 6, Close Look at the Crooks. There are two segments of this world Jewish conspiracy, both aiming at world conquest and both using the strategy divide and conquer. One segment, the Friends of the Captain, is Zionist and capitalist. They promote the world Jewish conspiracy by gathering up gold by fake speculation and unfair merchandising, then using the gold to buy up newspapers and other media with which to brainwash the people. They also exaggerate upper-class arrogance and wealth, thus promoting class war. Chapter 7, Friends of the Captain. The other segment of world Jewry operates as Friends of the Crew. So Friends of the Captain, Friends of the Crew, they latch onto and promote bad elites and bad proles and bad class relations as well as bad race relations. The other segment of world Jewry operates as Friends of the Crew. They preach violent class warfare from below. Communism, mutiny. The communist Jews believe they can thus fulfill the ancient Jewish prophecies of world domination by the bloody violence of world revolution. They need endless masses of easily manipulated humanity. So the Jews promote first the breeding of huge colored swarms and then their incitement to a Marxist mutiny against the elite white minority. Chapter 8, Friends of the Crew. To destroy the hated whites and thus advance their violent world revolution, the Jews promote the endless breeding, arming, and organizing of the colored world. They move hordes of blacks into urban areas, forcing them into competition with whites, and then, when the blacks fail, the Jews convince them that they are being, quote, oppressed. This produces riots and finally armed rebellion, both in America and elsewhere. As a result of this Jewish promotion of colored breeding, the colored birth rate is skyrocketing, while the best of the whites are killing each other off in fratricidal wars and by birth control, brother wars and birth control. Remember, all the sexual stuff, the porn, the abortion, even the condoms, the prophylactics, was all illegal right until the period in which he was writing this, when Jews changed all the laws, not just the immigration law. So while blacks are being told they're oppressed and getting into armed rebellion and violent crime everywhere, while whites are in fratricidal wars to help Jews in Israel and using birth control and family planning, and they're the taxed portion of the population, the enslaved. What you tax, you get less of. Therefore, what you subsidize, you get more of. Well, whites are taxed, so there's fewer whites, and blacks are subsidized, so there's more blacks each step of the way. The end will be world racial warfare, in which the swarming colored races will be pitted against the minority of whites for survival. Either the colored swarms, led and inflamed by Jews, will overwhelm the white minority and inherit a ruined world, or we will smash them. It's them or us. Chapter 9, Black Plague. The Negro masses are biologically inferior and easily manipulated, but the Jews can't as easily manipulate white men, so they are doing everything possible to destroy the idea that there is any such thing as race, with the intention of breeding the white man, especially the Nordic, out of existence. Chapter 10, The Facts of Race. Ahead lies all-out world race war, with blacks mutinying in the armed forces, with the whites paralyzed by love, quote-unquote, and integration propaganda, with the fearful weapons of modern white technology falling into the hands of black terrorists and being used against their white creators to create a Marxist, mongrel, Jewish, UN-dominated America. Marxist, mongrel, Jewish, UN-dominated America. Chapter 11, Nightmare. In the face of this hideous threat, the only white response has been 50 years of failure, because our side has insisted on, quote, fighting, unquote, only in the Jew-built conservative, quote, playpen. Conservatism is the politics of the playpen. Never mentioning the Jewish enemy and never fighting him on the only grounds which can unite our squabbling side, race. The only grounds that can unite our side is race, he says. Conservatives have been suckered into 50 years of fighting on the Jews' favorite grounds, economic manipulations. These would be your GDP arguments. They're good for the economy, you know, et cetera, while the nature of your and the culture of your people is thrown away. They talk about trivialities. Conservatives drive our own masses away from us by preaching economic royalism, just as the Jews want. In spite of this conservative stupidity, he basically means libertarianism by that, royalism. The healthy racial instincts of our working people have been leading them steadily to the right, until a substantial portion are now following Wallace. But even Wallace accommodates the Jews by denying race and by cooperating with the devilish Jewish enemy. No leader, even Wallace, who stays in the Jewish playpen, can hope to win. Only a leader who tells the revolutionary truth and tells all of it can win. Only a leader who tells all the truth can win. And that includes the fact that Adolf Hitler fought the Alamo of our white race, and that the enemy is Jewish and Negro. Chapter 12, 50 Years of Failure. Instead of such honesty, however, the conservative movement is used and manipulated by Jews who pose as our leaders, we heard about last time. Those who have followed there, maybe it was two times ago, those who have followed these facts and arguments must now be asking themselves, as I once did, what does it all mean? What are we to do? Can we win? And if so, how? The purpose of this chapter, again, chapter 14, is to show the reader that there is a historically proven method of smashing these arrogant red Jews and their colored troops. Hitler did it, which is precisely why they hate him and revile his name and anything connected with him so bitterly. They hate Hitler because they fear him, because he spoke the truth and he found the right way to defeat Jews. Germany found itself in exactly the same revolutionary mess we now face. We have been forced into a crazy Vietnam War that we weren't allowed to win. Mobs here at home are sabotaging the kids out there fighting. They even attack troops, trains, and ammunition ships and get away with it. German troops, fighting at the front in World War I, found themselves sabotaged from the rear by a Jewish Marxist revolution, just as we have here now. Jews caused a vast ammunition strike, so the troops had nothing to shoot at, or nothing to shoot, no ammunition, and stirred up a mutiny in the German Navy at Kiel, fomenting many commie revolutions all over Germany while the honorable Aryans were out fighting at the front. Here in America, Jews and their allies promote draft dodging, give aid and comfort to the enemy, and promote outright rebellion among Negroes who shout, "Hell no, we won't go." Again, this is right in the middle of the Vietnam War when he's writing. We find Jewish scum hanging up Viet Cong or communist flags in our streets and burning our American flag. In the states of Bavaria, Hesse, and Saxony in Germany, the Reds seized governments. They hung up their hammer and sickle rags and dragged the German flag in the mud. In Germany, the Jews had used the methods of capitalism to gather up almost all the wealth, to become almost all the professors, almost all the lawyers, almost all the doctors, and to push Germans out of the professions. Jews dominated Germany through the press, the professions, and the power of money. Central banking, media, and then taking over the state and the larger private business till they have a monopoly almost everywhere you look, which is what it is today. Here in America, we have the same thing happening, with the percentage of Jews in high positions going up and Jews quietly dominating America through control of the press, professions, and money. While rich German Jews were seizing all the top professional jobs, the communist Jew labor agitators were turning millions of German working men into enemies of their own people, into rabid, violent communists. Just like Jews are doing to many U.S. laboring men through rotten red unions. The Jews in Germany, like typical parasites, devoured the wealth of the nation so greedily that they wrecked the economy and ruined the currency, bringing on catastrophic inflation. We have precisely the same thing going on here, with only the degree of crisis not yet the same as it was in Germany. But all-out inflation is just ahead. And with the closing of the gold window of maybe 5-8 years after he wrote this, from there, productivity increased, but pay did not, and inflation did take off. The Jews in Germany had almost total control of the press and all other media for reaching the minds and hearts of the people, and were using the power to sow degeneracy, chaos, and mindless hedonism among the German people. Is it any different here in America today? The Jews in Germany, with their communist lies and propaganda, had incited and inflamed millions of Germans to hatred of their fellow Germans. Without understanding what was causing their poverty and misery, they filled the German streets with violent, rioting mobs. Is it any different here in America today? The Jews in Germany, before World War II, were pushing homosexuality, loose morals, filthy literature, crazy dances fresh from the African jungles, insane art, Marxist music, and self-indulgence for youth. Is it any different here in America today? No! The Jews, wrecked Germany. They have almost wrecked America. In Germany, at the last minute, from out of the soul of the German people, came forth a man with the spiritual power and leadership to reassert the supremacy of the German majority, restore German honor, and build a healthy, wholesome society. A simple German corporal arose and gathered about him brave comrades who would rather die than watch their people smashed and enslaved by Jews. Adolf Hitler launched a gigantic renaissance of the people that astonished the entire world. Hitler used the eternal laws of revolution and counter-revolution to smash illegal Jewish power and reassert the legitimate power of the majority of the German people. The reason our side in America has done nothing but retreat in such a disgusting and cowardly manner for 50 years is that, so far, nobody on our side has ever applied these eternal laws of revolution, power, and mass politics to our problem. These eternal laws of revolution, power, and mass politics. Eternal laws. Our side has been too powerful and wealthy for too long to be able to feel any real possibility of defeat and death. Our side has been playing a kid's game of economic conservatism, while the enemy, professional revolutionaries almost to a man, has been systematically destroying our power, our wealth, and our ability to resist. Every day, every year, we get weaker and they get stronger. The continued existence of Western civilization and the white race depends on whether enough Americans are sufficiently concerned about imminent catastrophe to do something professional and revolutionary about it, rather than continue to play this easy, kosher conservative playpen games of the last 50 years. And you're free to borrow his phrasing if you want to make fun of the same set that's still running around as the fake opposition. Easy, kosher, conservative playpen games. Playpen games. Kosher conservatives. Playpen games. We are facing a revolution, and a bloody one at that. States' rights, conservatism, Wallaceism, all in quotes, and even the Klan are only crunching Maginot lines, walls which may delay the brutal advance of the enemy a bit, but which will never stop him. French line in, I think, World War I, or was it World War II? The Germans easily just went around. Only an attack. Well, our only crumbling Maginot lines, which walls which may delay the brutal advance of the enemy, but which will never stop him. Only an attack can do these things, and no half-hearted Vietnam-style attack either. But the old-fashioned kind in which our purpose is simple and direct, to annihilate the enemy, to smash him, beat him down, and exterminate him until he is no longer a threat. That approach to Jews is the only one that can work and must work. That's an eternal law, he's saying. You can't defend yourself except by attacking and destroying. There's no half in, half out on it. No dabbling. The reason our people are unable to see the urgent, desperate need for a revolution, instead of the silly conservative shilly-shallying in the Jewish playpen, is that almost all of our people, on both sides, left and right, have fallen victim to Jewish propaganda against extremism and radicalism. Extremism in quotes. The attack upon us is called, even by the enemy, a, quote, black revolution. It is communist. It is lawless. It is radical, violent, and bloody. The only defense that has even a prayer of succeeding must be equally radical. When somebody is shooting at you, only counterfire can succeed. Anyone might be pardoned for believing for a few minutes or even an hour or so that he might be able to talk his way out of a gunfight. But when the shooting goes on, gets more and more bloody, and the enemy openly proclaims his intention of wiping you out, as the blacks are doing, it is madness and suicide to keep depending on the easy, nice, moderate, conservative methods of survival. The way you shoot back in a revolution is with a revolution of your own. They have started a black revolution. Only a white revolution can stop it. And that's what this book is all about. That's what this book is all about, a white revolution. Over the past 20 years, I have run the course from Republican to hardshell Republican to anti-communist to McCarthyite to Birch-type conservative to sneaky Nazi and finally to all-out national socialist, Hitlerite. I have become a revolutionary as dedicated to professional, hard-boiled white man's anti-communist revolution as any communist is dedicated to his bloody revolution. And a white man's anti-communist revolution to succeed must be something more than just against the other side. It must be a revolution for something so grand and noble that a man can give his life heroically fighting for it. Men will talk about almost anything. Men will fight for very few things. And men will fight to the death for only the most basic of motives. They will fight heroically, that is, with supreme self-sacrifice, which is what heroism means, supreme self-sacrifice, only for idealistic aims they hold greater and more holy than their own personal survival. Only when you can make a man feel, deep in his heart, that survival of his loved ones, his honor, or his whole people are in deadly danger, will he risk his life to do battle against overwhelming odds where his own personal survival is unlikely. The Jews are filled to overflowing with this family feeling, so that they not only stick together, as is well known, but they sacrifice and give for each other too, as the records of any Jewish fund appeal will show. And the rush of Jews even to fight for their precious Israel shows this even more. Pointedly, it is this fanatic family feeling which makes the Jews such a power in the world. The blacks today have also been filled by Jewish agitation with this same feeling of fighting for their family, for their own, to the point where they go out by the thousands and face beatings, fire hoses, jails, and even death to advance the revolution of their soul brothers. But America's anti-communist leadership, so far, is hung up on money, security, comfort, luxury, and Sunday evening tea-sipping anti-communism that nobody will sacrifice much for, such disgusting materialism, let alone give his life heroically for such cowardly leaders. The masses of working people, especially, are not only not won over to fight for their own side by the bloomers, Buckley, rabbit, by the bloomers, Buckley, Rabbit Welch, Fatty Hargis, and Dry Goods Goldwater economic approaches, but, as we have shown in 50 years of failure, the masses are positively repelled and disgusted by this selfish money madness of the would-be anti-communist leadership. Today they just call them grifters and be done with it. To fire up our people to fight the flaming counter-revolution, we must launch at the Jewish and Negro enemy. We must give our people an overwhelming sense of family, an urgent, self-sacrificing, idealistic drive to draw together and fight for our own. Wallaceism is the next-to-last step toward that goal. But Wallaceism must fail, as have all the other half-measures, because it lacks the guts and honesty to give the masses that powerful, open feeling of family, open in all caps, without which, I guess that he means public by that, without which it is just one more, even if temporarily more successful, effort to sneak up on the Jewish enemies without naming them and even by cooperating with them. Again, contrasting sneakiness and openness. There were no anonymous Nazis. The fuel which feeds the fires behind Wallaceism is racism, the very feeling of family of which I have written. The Jews have demonized with that very term and its creation and its publicity. But Wallace endlessly repeats, "I am not racist. Racism is evil." The people don't believe him, of course. The enthusiasm he generates is a racial family feeling. not political. Wallace is the best racial symbol of our white family that has been allowed by the Jews, through compromise, to rise as a national and somewhat respectable figure. But that very compromise by which Wallace has achieved some respectability will eventually give the Jews the power to destroy Wallace, and destroy him they will, just as they have crushed all other compromisers for 50 years. It is not the compromisers and the respectable nice guys who have the power to inflame and lead the masses of people in times of bloody revolution, but the wild, rabid, flaming extremists. The Patrick Henrys, the Lenins, the Garibaldis, the Kenyattas, and the Hitlers, the men most hated and cursed by whatever power they are fighting. Let me make it clear that I am not implying that these men are anything alike. My point is that each of them succeeded against a starting lineup of dozens of other would-be leaders only because they were the most extreme. Lenin won in Russia over the more moderate Mensheviks precisely because he was exiled and jailed as the most violent and extreme among all the competing leaders. Jomo Kenyatta, the Mau Mau leader, won power in Kenya precisely because he was tossed in jail as the most violent, radical, and bloody cannibal leader. Here in America, Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown are inevitably winning the hearts of the black masses precisely because they are the most violent, radical, and extreme black leaders and will probably go to jail, which will help make them all the more the leaders of the blacks. I think they actually fled to Africa before that could happen, but doesn't disprove his point. On an absolutely different plane, Adolf Hitler won the hearts of the German people and won power precisely because he too was thrown in jail as the most extreme, most radical, and uncompromising of all the competing, quote, nationalist, unquote, leaders. These ultimate leaders of revolution are always hated and cursed by the compromisers and cowards on their own side, because the cowards and compromisers are desperately eager to avoid the bloody terrorism of the enemy. So the compromisers try to win the enemy's temporary favor by blasting away at the genuine revolutionaries who alone can win what these parlor revolutionaries pretend to fight for. Thus we find almost every anti-communist leader in America, from Buckley to Welch, slyly spreading the lie that I, Rockwell, am working for the Jews and communists by provoking the enemy. Sure, I provoke the enemy, just as a soldier provokes the enemy by shooting at him. The compromisers and kosher conservatives hope that by blasting me viciously enough, they will win the trust and love of their Jewish pals. Although every major Jewish organization and leader in America is viciously blasting away at Welch, Buckley, Hargis, and the rest of my best friends are Jews bunch. The my best friends are Jews bunch. So compromising doesn't even work in its own terms. How can you fight and win without provoking the enemy? Deep in their hearts, the masses of people and many of the leaders already feel that the Jewish, Negro, and communist problem has gone far, far past the point where we can talk the enemy out of power. He's saying this 60 years ago, right? The ordinary working man knows the enemy has forced us into a fight to survive and keep what we have built when he sees what the blacks are doing in America. If our people are to have any hope of eventual victory, we must have a hardcore revolutionary cadre organized and ready to assume leadership when Wallaceism, the last hope of the compromisers, folds up. Hardcore revolutionary cadre, organized, ready to assume leadership. Where's that coming from? To organize and train that hardcore cadre of revolutionary white leaders is and has been my naked purpose in building the American Nazi Party. When the communists had had enough of Kerensky's hanky-panky, Lenin was able to grab power, even though he had to come from far behind in the leadership race, because he stuck resolutely to the hard, tough, no-compromise line and was ready when the time was ripe, in spite of all jails and persecutions. When the Germans had had enough hanky-panky with von Papen, Bruning et al., Hitler was able to win power, even though he had to come from far behind in the leadership race, because he stuck resolutely to the hard, tough, no-compromise line and was ready when the time was ripe, in spite of jails and persecutions. When the wild blacks in Kenya had had enough of the hanky-panky of the moderate pro-British black leaders, Jomo Kenyatta was able to come from behind in the leadership race because he stuck resolutely to the hard, tough, no-compromise line and was ready when the time was ripe, in spite of the fact he was doing a long jail sentence then. No matter how we suffer and go to jail, starve, and are cursed by our own side today, I know with historical certainty that the Nazi Party will have the strength to come from far behind when the time is ripe and our people are finally disgusted with the endless compromisers from Welch to Wallace. When they want to fight, when they are ready to sacrifice anything rather than bow to Negroes and Jews one more day, nothing can stop us. For we shall have behind us the mightiest force on the planet, millions and millions of fighting mad white men, filled with that holy and revolutionary sense of family, which has proven unconquerable down through the ages. The situation with the revolutionary bloody blacks forcing the calling out of the army in Detroit, even as I write these words, has now gone past the point where a Wallace can deal with it on a states' rights basis. Already it is clear that it will take a massive and unified federal effort to restore order and sanity. I think that was the 67-68 riots in Detroit. When our people have had enough black revolution and conservative cowardice, then we will be ready to smash the enemy with white revolution. With that, he closes chapter 14. So, eventually you got to quit compromising. You got to fight, and that's what Nazi means. We are the ones who fight. The conservatives are the ones who quiver, equivocate, who compromise, tergiversate, and ultimately do nothing but represent cowardice in bodily form. Cowardice is an ideal. Might be described as conservatism. What they call prudence on the page is cowardice in the street and cowardice in life. So don't be a conservative. Be a white revolutionary. Ben Alex Linder reading to you out of George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power. We've just completed chapter 14. I'll be back with you one more time and we'll do the comparatively brief 15 and 16 to end this fine book. And again, permanent archive at vnnforum.com. Be back with you again real soon.